From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring a case playing out in Utah involving a group of animal rights activists who are trying to expose what they say are cruel and abusive conditions for turkeys and pigs in industrial farms in the state. These activists filmed what they saw. Now they're facing multiple charges. The journalist Glenn Greenwald will be among our guests. He's been reporting on these cases. This is about the conflict between industrial meat production and the rights of animals. After this. Hi, it's Doug Fabrizio, and our latest short on Radio West Films has the comedian Aaron Woodall breaking down his favorite joke. It was something difficult he'd been wanting to say to an audience at BYU, something about going on a mission. And it was one of those jokes that he had to land just right, but saying what he had to say, it could be a tough crowd. Go see the film at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Last year, a group of animal rights activists used virtual reality technology to film the conditions inside two industrial farms in Utah, one a turkey operation in Moroni, the other a large pig production plant in Milford. In fact, that one is one of the largest in the country. The activists say what they found was barbaric and cruel, filthy living spaces, sick and dying animals. These activists are part of a group called Direct Action Everywhere. They use this virtual reality as part of their public campaign. They don't hide their faces. In fact, this transparency is part of the point. Another one of the tactics is called Open Rescue, where they actually took some of what they insisted were dying animals, three turkeys, two piglets in the Utah cases, and they passed them along to animal rescue shelters. Now, the activists are being charged with felony theft as well as rioting and racketeering. These charges carry with them some serious prison time. So today in the program, we're going to be talking about these stories. The investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald is joining us today. He says the reason state and federal prosecutors are pursuing cases like this is that the tide of public opinion about animal cruelty is turning, but the factory farming industry still has some powerful influence. Greenwald is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist, a co-founder of The Intercept. It's an online news publication. He's reported extensively on the activities of animal rights activists on factory farms in Utah and the legal cases against them. We have links, by the way, to those articles on our website. He's joining us from his office in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, where he's based. And Glenn Greenwald, welcome to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I want to begin with, in your reporting, you describe the conditions at places like Circle 4 Farms in Milford as abuse and cruelty. And you say this, that it's inherent in the procedures of these places. I wanted to talk a little bit about the conditions first to get some groundwork there. Would you talk about that?
Sure. So obviously when you see videos of animal rights workers overtly abusing animals by beating them or using electric prods against them, all things that have happened, that's illegal and people react with horror. But even when they abide by the law, the animals are subjected to horrific torture and suffering. Pigs, for example, are often kept in crates where for many months at a time, if not their entire lives, they literally can't even turn around because the crates are so narrow. They're bred to have piglets that they don't see, that they often stomp on. They never see the light of day. And in the farm, the turkey farm in Utah, the companies and the farms advertise this kind of bucolic branding where you're supposed to believe that the turkeys are organic because they're raised in the Utah mountains. But the reality is much different. They're stuffed into these warehouses and factories where they can barely move one on top of the other. They often peck each other to death. They have open wounds. They're injured. They're diseased. It's the kind of thing that if you look at any human being with a conscience react with horror, which is exactly why this industry is so devoted to keeping these conditions a secret.
In your reporting, you say, despite having little in the way of political clout, that these activists have managed to come up with some fairly shrewd techniques. And this seems to be a significant dynamic, a new element entered into this story, the open rescue techniques, the idea of transparency. Talk a little bit about this, because this seems like a new twist to the story.
Sure. So the internet, when it was first became widespread, the promise of it was that it would revolutionize how we were able to communicate with one another, because you didn't need television networks any longer, extremely expensive camera equipment in order to film things. You could just literally now use your cell phone. Even the poorest places in the world are able to film war conditions and upload it to the internet, which has expanded our understanding of how the world really works. That is definitely the case for factory farms. For decades, for many years at least in this country, in the US, it was a felony to film inside factory farms without the permission of the corporations that owned it. And those courts have now slowly but surely invalidated these laws on the grounds that they violate free speech and free press to turn someone into a felon for doing nothing more than reporting and filming. And so now they're searching for ways to punish activists who make the world see what really goes on inside of these facilities, precisely because this industry depends upon you eating a slab of meat or of bacon and not thinking about the torture and suffering and brutality and barbarism that goes into putting that food on your plate. And they've been incredibly innovative, these activists have, with very little money, using cameras and technology and just brave activism to go into these facilities, to film what's going on covertly, and then making people on the internet see what it is that's going on so that journalists like me and others can begin to report on it. And I think this recent spate of prosecutions was triggered by the fact that the largest media outlets in the country, including the New York Times, are now reporting on what these activists are doing in pretty positive ways. And that's really scaring these industries about the effect and success that these activists are having.
Hmm. How did this go down, the arrests or the charge? I mean, one of the things you mention and you describe, Glenn, an armada of FBI agents descending on these small shelters that these animals had been taken to, one of which is in Riverton, Utah, I should point out. Talk a little bit about how that played out. You talk about dramatic questioning and just the tactics that happened.
Right. So I think just, you know, in the first place, I think it's important to put all this into context. You can obviously believe that it's against the law to trespass onto factory farms and to take a pig or two that's dying. But there's always a question of proportionality in law enforcement. So jaywalking is illegal. It's against the law, but we don't put people in prison for 20 years for it. And nobody would think that was justified on the grounds that, well, jaywalking is illegal, so anyone deserves what they get. The same is true here. So, you know, you can certainly say that going onto this property without permission is trespassing, which is usually a misdemeanor. Nobody goes to jail for trespassing. Taking two dying piglets has a commercial value that's incredibly trivial. And yet what's happening in these cases is the full weight of law enforcement is being employed as though these were really threatening crimes that are menacing the security of the community. So in the case of the Smithfield investigation, for example, the activists went into the facility, they filmed what was taking place there, how the pigs were being treated. It led to stories in my publication, in Vox, and the New York Times. And the FBI deployed agents across the country to try and find the two piglets that had been rescued. They were taken to a sanctuary to execute search warrants and conduct DNA tests on them in order to build a criminal case against the activists who are now being charged with multiple felony counts, including racketeering, the kinds of things that are usually reserved for mobsters, people who murder witnesses and terrorize communities. Even though whatever you think of what they did, even if you think it's a crime, the consequences are incredibly minimal. There's no commercial value that they're causing to be injured. If anything, they're probably saving these companies money by rescuing dying animals and therefore saving them the cost of corpse disposal. But what you see is that, as is true in so many areas of our democracy, our government and our law enforcement agencies are controlled by the richest corporations who can exploit and abuse the powers of prosecutors and the FBI to punish their political dissidents and their political opponents. And that's exactly what's happening here.
How do you describe the influence of the factory farm industry? One of the things that you mention is that these these laws, or certainly the prosecutions going on now, not proportional, as you say, are really not about property rights, but they're about reputational interests of the industry.
Exactly. I mean, we've seen this in so many cases. I mean, the reporting that I did that won the Pulitzer, as you mentioned at the beginning, was about exactly the same thing. It was a series of agencies, national security agencies, who were spying on American citizens and lying to the public about it. And they tried to cover that up, invoking national security justifications and secrecy powers, not to protect the national security of the United States, but to protect their own reputations and their own political interests and to conceal their own wrongdoing. And that's exactly the same here. These corporations spend huge amounts of money donating hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars to both political parties, to political candidates who are likely to win. In Utah, for example, almost every single significant prosecutor and political official of any influence has all kinds of financial and professional ties to the agribusiness industry. And so they're able to control government for their own ends, these private actors, these private corporate actors. And not just when it comes to enacting laws that are written specifically to benefit these industries at the expense of everybody else, but even to control the Attorney General's office in Utah, which they've donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to through various other organizations. And so it's really corporate capture of our government and the abuse of the law enforcement process to punish people who are doing nothing more than making their fellow citizens aware of what is taking place within factory farms.
You write about this sort of revolving door that's going on. And you say the USDA is the most blatant, dominated, as you say, by executives from the factory farms that themselves need the actual regulation. And I wanted you to talk about one particular example, the current Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, former governor of Georgia. You use him as an example in your reporting.
Right. So when Sonny Perdue was the governor of Georgia, he received enormous sums of money from industrial factory farms and animal agricultural industry. He himself has a business that is tied to that industry, so his family has profited off of them. It's a little bit of an interesting case in the case of Sonny Perdue, because he began as a veterinarian who obviously cared for animals at one point. But even there, the veterinarian work that he did was in service of animal agriculture. But he's now become the kind of classic case of somebody who, as you said, works in the revolving door where they go from an industry right into the government office that's supposed to regulate that industry. And then, as often happens so frequently, when they leave government, they go back to the industry that they were so good to and get rewarded. In other cases, for example, let's say with those people who regulate Wall Street, and they begin on Wall Street, then they go to government where they regulate Wall Street, then they go back to Wall Street and get rewarded for the lax regulation. There's at least a political debate. There's a organized group that's kind of against Wall Street domination. In the case of animal agriculture, there's very little money and very little organization trying to speak on behalf of voiceless animals who are being systemically tortured and slaughtered. And that's why it's so extreme there. It's almost like it's political pilfering without any opposition. And amazingly, you can look at the Department of Agriculture's own internal investigations by their inspector general. Every 5 years they issue a report, and every 5 years they say, we're not even enforcing the minimal laws on people who experiment on animals, on people who grow animals, when they break the law. To the great suffering of animals or even death, they get fines that are so trivial that they just write them off as a cost of business, and it doesn't provide any incentive, and yet it never changes because industry executives continue to be appointed to the position. It's the ultimate case of foxes guarding the hen house.
Along the lines of proportional prosecution and resources used, one of the things you point out is that the amount of resources being expended in these kinds of cases now to prosecute these six activists, for example, and others, you mentioned that as they're spending a lot of money on these things.
They're spending an enormous amount of money. Just think about, for example, what it costs to conduct a full-scale nationwide FBI hunt for two piglets. the lawyers who were involved who got to go to drop the search warrants and go to court, the prosecutors who were then deployed on both the state, federal, and local level in order to investigate and then in order to prosecute, the court employees who end up having to spend their time prosecuting people as felons who did nothing more than take two dying piglets or three dying turkeys to a veterinarian and then to a sanctuary. And then the prison itself, putting these people in prison, taking them out of society, away from their families, away from their jobs, and having to turn them into prisoners and pay for that. It's enormous amounts of public funds that are being wasted strictly to serve the interest of an industry that has no intention here other than to conceal and hide what it is they're doing. It would be one thing if these animal rights activists were burning down factories, were gravely harming property and causing people to lose their jobs. You could have a debate then about whether that's justified, about what kind of punishments were warranted. This is a completely different case. These are peaceful animal rights activists imposing no commercial harm on any industry except by shining a light on what it is they're doing. They're being punished for their reporting. They're being punished for their free speech. And no matter where you fall on this whole debate about animal agriculture and the treatment of animals, we all have an interest in making certain that corporations can't abuse the power of law to punish people for exercising their constitutional rights of free speech and a free press. But that's exactly what's happening here.
We invited a representative from Smithfield Foods to join us. They declined. I wanted to have you respond to some of the things they've talked about in terms of this video of the at the Utah hog farm. They say based on, and this is a statement they released back in the summer, they said based on a review of, and you write about this in your reporting, but based on a review, they said the video appears to be highly edited, even staged in an attempt to manufacture an animal care issue where one does not exist. They say the video features blatant inaccuracies and assertions which not could not be further from the truth. And we could go on for some other things, but I wanted to give you a sense to, chance to sort of respond to what you found about those kinds of contentions.
So all you have to do is look at the video to see that Smithfield is lying in their statement. For example, what the video shows is huge factory facilities with thousands upon thousands of pigs being kept in what are called gestation crates, where they are in cages so tiny that they can't even turn around, let alone move. How could animal rights activists, five or six of them, possibly stage something like that? That would require a level of budget that Hollywood films rarely even have. You can look at the diseased pigs and the injured pigs and the pile of corpses of pigs that are on the film, and that too would be impossible to stage or to replicate. Obviously, what has happened in this case is that Smithfield Farms has spent years making claims about their treatment of pigs that are false. And the reason they're able to do that is because they've made it illegal to film or to report on what takes place inside their facilities. And now, for the first time in a long time, we have actual film, actual footage, video footage of the reality and the truth of what takes place on their facilities. And of course, so what are they going to say? They only have two options. They can either say, okay, we got caught lying systematically to the public, and we actually do inflict great suffering on these pigs, directly contrary to what we've been saying. Or they can attack the integrity of the animal rights activists, hoping enough people believe them, by saying that, well, they staged it or they edited it. They're incredibly vague. It lacks specifics, these accusations. And I just challenge anybody to look at the videos and make up your own mind about what it is that you're seeing in these videos.
Well, how do you react to Norbest, who contracts with the turkey operation in Moroni? Let me read from the statement they issued. They said, we are deeply disappointed that our standards were not upheld by the farmers in question, by the farmer in question. We will reexamine every step in our training and inspection process to determine whether there is more we can do to guarantee animal care standards are met. This seems like a different kind of response, expressing regret that these kinds of conditions actually existed. What do you think about that?
Right. So, I mean, first of all, think about how amazing this is. So Norbest which is the corporation that was supplied turkeys by this farm that was filmed by these activists.
Yeah.
They admitted that what was taking place in this facility that these activists filmed was horrific and unacceptable and below their standards. And they vowed that they would improve in the future, and they even ultimately terminated the contract with this facility. So what these activists showed, even according to the corporate executives who were getting fed the turkeys by this facility, was shocking to the conscience. And yet Utah prosecutors are prosecuting these activists for showing this under felony laws and threatening to send them to prison for many years. How can that possibly be justified that they expose wrongdoing that even the corporation admits was wrong, and now they're being threatened with prison by Utah prosecutors? But even in that case, that happens a lot where, you know, it's sort of like, I'm shocked that gambling is taking place here. It's that kind of Casablanca mentality. These corporations know exactly what these facilities do in order to raise and then slaughter the turkeys that they make profit on. And then when it gets exposed, in the rare cases that it does, they feign shock and horror, pretending they didn't know what was taking place. The only difference in this case is that in this case it got exposed because these activists happened to film inside of it. But this is what the industry does. It's what this industry is.
What I wanted to ask you about the charges that they face, being prosecuted for felony theft charges. You mentioned the racketeering, the rioting, some fairly hefty punishments involved here. What do you make of the chances here, and how do you explain or describe the charges as they're being laid out?
So let's just look at this one instance where they're being charged with felony theft. Usually people, even if you're not familiar with the law, you know that if you walk into a convenience store and you steal a couple of packs of gum, you're not going to be charged with felony theft because the value of what you've stolen isn't high enough to be a felony. It would be misdemeanor theft. So in this case, the activist stole three turkeys who were on the verge of death, or two piglets who were dying. But let's assume they weren't even dying. Let's assume they were going to make it to the slaughterhouse. Still, the value is at most, you know, $50, $100. So how is it that they're being charged with felony theft? And the answer is that the lobbyists for the agricultural industry in Utah so completely control the legislative process that when the Utah legislators wrote the felony theft statute, it said you can be charged with felony theft if you steal something that has a value of greater than $1,500. So it has to be more than $1,500. Or you'll be charged with felony theft if you steal livestock being raised for commercial purposes.
Yeah.
So they specifically wrote into the felony theft law a clause that says if you steal from the animal industry, no matter how trivial the value is, you'll still be charged as a felon, even though in every other case when you steal, it has to be more than $1,500. Not only that, they're being charged as racketeers, which is a pattern of criminal behavior under laws that were basically written to criminalize the mafia and to make it possible to punish the mafia with very long prison terms. So these activists in these two cases in Utah are literally facing 6 decades in prison because they rescued a grand total of 5 dying animals and brought them to the shelter. And of course, the real reason they're being punished, their real crime, is that they brought attention to the abuses of this industry. And, you know, these activists are incredibly brave. They knew what the risks were, and they took them anyway because they feel so deeply that what's going on is wrong. Just like whistleblowers who blow the whistle on government wrongdoing, from Daniel Ellsberg to Edward Snowden, also, you know, are willing to take risks in order to expose things that they think are wrong. We need people like this in our society. We need more people like this in our society. And we ought to band together to protect them when they're being persecuted as they are.
We have less than a minute with you. I wanted to ask you one final question because it's something you get at in your writing. You say one of the things is that the core moral and philosophical question is now being debated. What is that question? What's the essence here going on?
Well, we know from science that animals suffer and experience great pain. We love our dogs, and yet pigs, for example, are at least as intelligent and as emotionally complex and social as dogs are. So at some point, we're going to have to come to grips with how is it morally justified not just to kill animals for food, but to subject them to the most horrific lives of torture and pain and suffering from the moment they're born until the moment we're killed. It's really a profound moral question that science is making more difficult to ignore.
It's Glenn Greenwald. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, co-founder of The Intercept, an online news publication. We have links to his articles on our website, radiowest.org. Mr. Greenwald, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about a story from last year. At least that's when it played out. It's a case that involves a group of animal rights activists who are trying to expose what they say are cruel and abusive conditions for turkeys and pigs in industrial farms in the state. These activists filmed what they saw. Now they're facing multiple charges, possible prison time. Joining us now on the program is Kevin Daniels. He is the San Pete County attorney leading the prosecution of some of these activists from that group called Direct Action Everywhere. He's joining us from his office in Manti. And Mr. Daniels, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your program.
Let me get you to broadly react to some of the contentions of Mr. Greenwald, that these tactics, the charges, for example, are excessive. They're not really proportional. We can get into some specifics here in a moment, but to the general case that this is a tactic because these federal judges are ruling unconstitutional, these ag gag laws, that this is just another end run around it. So what's your general reaction to all of that?
Well, quite frankly, I think it's ludicrous. And the reason for that is, honestly, I think this is a case of apophenia, meaning seeing a conspiracy where there is none. I'm a huge believer in the marketplace of ideas. Oliver Wendell Holmes first, coined and brought that term into consciousness, which is why I'm even on your program. Normally, it's not our practice to discuss cases in the media, but I felt that it was important in this case. There's no wide conspiracy to quell the voice of those animal rights activists. With regard to, proportionality, I'll get into all that in just a minute.
Okay.
But, it's just ludicrous. I mean, it's quite simple and it's, for me, it's a case of the rule of law. Me and my job of upholding the rule of law and then violating the rule of law. There were proper legal ways that they could have gone about bringing the alleged abuses to light. They did not follow that, and that's why our office is prosecuting it.
So to the question, did you get any kind of guidance from the state or even from the federal government, for that matter, in terms of the charges that you were going to pursue on a county level? Because there's this question that Mr. Greenwald raises about whether there's improper coordination among the different agencies involved. What was that relationship like, if you can explain it?
Well, as you can see in the differing nature of the charges, if you look at the charges filed in my county by me, they're vastly different than what was filed in, I'm not even sure if it was Beaver County or Millard County, but with the Smithfield cases. So that in and of itself shows that there was no coordination whatsoever. Our charges are greatly different, including the level of the charges. And so I had one conversation with Norbest, and that was after I'd already filed the charges. Prior to that, my only conversations had been with the investigators investigating the case.
So did you, the fact that Judge Shelby has been one of the judges throughout the country that have been striking down these so-called ag gag laws, the fact that that has been determined to be by some judges that going against the First Amendment of the Constitution, was that an obstacle for you? Would you have been able to use these ag gag laws in the prosecution of these activists?
I wouldn't have used it. I wasn't a big fan of the ag gag laws when they were in effect. Hmm. As I stated earlier, I believe in the marketplace of ideas. Put your ideas out there, and then the public will purchase what they believe are the most viable ideas. I know in my county, in San Pete County, that's heavily reliant on the agricultural industry, and I'm not talking large corporate either. Yeah. Small farmers, medium farmers. We don't really have any large corporate farms, with Norbest probably being the largest. But with that being said, that's what the community in San Pete County wants. That I was pushed by the community, not by any corporate interests. I had zero conversations, with the exception of the one I had after, and it was a 2-minute conversation that simply asked me if I had filed charges. Beyond that, I've had numerous members of the community reach out to me, thank me for pursuing this. And so that's ultimately the two things that are driving this prosecution are the rule of law, first and foremost, and then the desires of the community where in which I live. Those are the big ones.
Yeah.
I mean, I've received a lot of input, if you will, from both animal rights activists and regular members of the community. The negative feedback that I've received, 100% of it has been outside the state of Utah. I've had very vile things said to me, which I always find ironic that people that are advocating for the humane treatment of animals will say things to me like they want me skinned alive.
Yeah.
pretty vile.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of our callers has raised this question that I wanted to talk to you about. She talks about how she says she's on board in part with the Glenn Greenwald's take of factory farming. And I think it's because she sees factory farming as, you know, massive and big. But she's also expressing some concern that these activist groups target smaller farms and that they use tactics that affect these smaller operations that don't have the same kinds of resources. And I'm wondering, kind of referring to something you said earlier, that these are smaller operations in particular in your county. Are you seeing something like that, where these smaller farms are affected and they don't have the same kinds of resources as larger factory farms?
That's exactly what I'm seeing. Every one of these individuals that has approached me obviously are connected in one way or another to the agricultural industry, whether that's producing feed for the turkeys and they are a small operation with only maybe 100 acres and they're floating just above the poverty line. They see this as a paternalistic, condescending attack on their way of life. It's a way of life that they choose. This isn't due to the lack of information. This is something they choose, and they feel like these animal rights activists, especially coming from outside the areas of the Intermountain West. We're dealing with people from California, Oregon, et cetera. And so they're seeing this as we disagree on the consumption of meat. You're entitled to your opinion, but why should you attack my economic way of life? That's what they're seeing this as. They're seeing this as a paternalistic attack that these animal rights activists know better than they do. That they're just stupid, and if they're enlightened, they'll come around.
I want to address something to give you a chance to respond to it. Glenn Greenwald says that you, Mr. Daniels, have a serious conflict of interest in the case because you work in a firm that has represented Smithfield Foods in numerous cases. So I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, it's interesting, you know, that he brings up the issue of influence. So is it improper for all the animal rights activists that have contacted me, over 100 of them, to try to influence my case? People are always going to try to influence an individual to their way of thinking. Now, with regard to the specific case, he's referring to Smithfield. I've had zero conversations with Smithfield on any subject since 2016. I have never had a conversation with Smithfield as to the issue of animal rights activists at any point. My last professional interaction with Smithfield was prior to me becoming county attorney in 2016 and was extremely limited in scope and duration. I dealt with an employment law issue. They simply wanted to know the effects that President Obama's employment law regulations would have on their operation. That's it. Didn't even deal with animals at all. It dealt with the employees of the company. As to my firm, I'm not even sure if they're an active client, to be honest with you. That's how often I deal with them. I am a named partner in Styler Daniels. I am acting as of counsel since becoming county attorney. But I'm not involved in the handling of Smithfield cases at all since 2016. Other members of my firm handle those. So to be honest with you, I'm not even really qualified to speak even to the nature of that relationship because I'm not that involved.
Can I just clarify, did you coordinate with the state attorney general's office in the charges?
No, they sent me one email. And that's the other thing. You know, if I had something to hide, I easily could have denied the grandma request on the grounds that it was an ongoing investigation. I had nothing to hide. Everything's been above board. As one can look to another criminal case that I had, I'm a very ethical prosecutor. I dealt with a death penalty case where I took the death penalty off the table once I found that there were some records issues. I take my ethical obligation very, very seriously.
But the email, maybe I'm reading it wrong, the email did suggest coordination on the part of the attorney general's. We should coordinate, it said.
It did request that. As you can see, if I would have responded, they probably would have published that email as well.
Okay.
I didn't respond to the email. For one, I'm just not a big email guy to begin with.
Yeah.
But two, I'm an independent prosecutor. I have a very strong independent streak in me, and I just didn't want to coordinate. I felt they were different cases. I felt they were different factual basis, different animals. So I wanted to go this alone.
Yeah. Do you think that these activists should spend time in prison?
No. And that's the funny thing. I think, while technically correct, I think it's intellectually dishonest to say that they're going to spend 10 years or 60 years in prison. First of all, anybody that looks into the criminal justice system, even just a little bit, would know that there's zero chance a judge, even if I requested it, would seek 2 0-to-5s consecutive. That's what would require them to spend 10 years in prison. Second of all, it's not even a case where I'd be requesting prison.
Hmm. So what do you want?
I don't think it's reflective of the harm.
Okay, so in terms of your response to Glenn Greenwald's sense that it lacks proportionality, you kind of agree with that. I mean, proportionally, you want some sort of a punishment, but you don't think prison is appropriate.
That's correct.
Okay.
I think that's fair to say. And that's why it's funny when I see it reported in the media, you know, that they're looking at 60 years. I can't speak to the Smithfield case because I am not involved in it at all. But as to my case, it's not a case where I'm going to be looking at prison, and I'm fine with going on the record and saying that. I do want to see some sort of punishment more reflective of the harm.
And would a misdemeanor be reflective of the harm rather than a felony?
At this stage, we're so early in the process, I'm not ruling anything out other than outright dismissal.
Okay.
They've retained counsel, and those are conversations we'll have down the road.
I see.
As to what the end game looks like, I don't know.
That's Kevin Daniels. He's the San Pete County attorney, joined us from his office in Manti. Mr. Daniels, we're grateful that you took the time to spend with us today. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Joining us now on the program is Wayne Shung, who is co-founder of the animal rights group Direct Action Everywhere. He's one of those who faces numerous felony charges, and he's joining us from a studio in San Francisco. And Mr. Shung, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
I want to begin. Could we back up a little bit and get a sense of, we don't have a lot of time, but I did want you to spend a moment with us and explain what motivates your sense of activism, because a lot of this goes back to when you were a young boy in China. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I was born in the United States in the Midwest, and in central Indiana, there weren't a lot of immigrants and not a lot of Chinese people. And so my dog was my best and pretty much my only friend. And my family had never actually gone back to China for 40 years because, you know, my dad was on the wrong side of a civil war that ended in 1949. So he and his family fled the country in 1949. And in 1989, 40 years later, we finally went back to our home country and got to see some of these family members that we had been separated from for 40 years. But what should have been a pretty cathartic and powerful and positive experience. And I remember my grandfather, who was a very hard man, a general in the military of Taiwan, crying for the first time in his life because he was seeing his little brother who he had missed for 40 years. It should have been this really powerful experience. But instead, for me, it was horribly traumatic because one of the first restaurants we went to in southern China was a restaurant called a Wild Earth restaurant. And these restaurants in southern China have live animals in cages. You can literally point to an animal. They'll slaughter the animal in the back. And in China, we don't draw as many distinctions between different types of animals. And one of the first animals we saw was a primate in a cage. There was a little monkey who had like a collar around her neck. And my dad and I both looked at this little poor monkey in shock. But the thing that just blew me away was I started hearing barking. And I asked my parents, oh, does somebody have a dog here? Because, you know, my dog Vivian was my best friend. And they said, no, there's dogs in cages and they're about to be slaughtered for meat. Yeah, I broke down in tears, and it was a moment in my life that I'll remember until the day that I die, because I just couldn't believe that these animals, who are just like my best friend at home, were about to be beaten to death and killed for food.
I guess, how do you make the distinction between what sounds like a horrific experience that you had in that restaurant and these experiences that you're documenting at these factory farms? Places like in Milford and in Moroni, do you see distinctions and differences? Clearly, there are conditions that need to be fixed and reformed. But how do you draw the distinctions between there's some regulation for sure, and there clearly have been abuses and the things like. But how are you sort of parsing the differences between the experience, the really terrible ones, and the ones that you? I mean, how do you think about that, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the experience of animals in factory farming in the United States is far worse than any dog used in the dog meat trade, because the dogs used in the dog meat trade, they're often stolen off the street. They're taken from shelters. They don't live a lifetime in a cage. But animals in factory farms do live lifetimes in cages. They're brutally mistreated and mutilated without sort of any sort of anesthetic and painkiller. And then the slaughter process is so mechanized and industrialized that none of them receive any sort of individual care. So you routinely see animals being ripped to pieces alive on the slaughter line. And you'll never see that in a dog meat slaughterhouse in China, because there's actually a human being who's responsible for killing every single one of these dogs. So one distinction is, I think the depravity and the degree of cruelty is far higher in factory farms in the United States. But the other distinction is, obviously, we're just taught something different in the United States than what my family was taught in China in the 1940s and 50s. And this is what my parents said to me when I was crying and begging them, hey, and there's a dog there that looks just like my little puppy, and I want to try and save her. And they kept saying to me, we can't. This is just what they're taught here. This is what they're taught here. And, you know, I'm actually not a natural lawbreaker or rule breaker. I was raised in a very law-abiding Confucian family, and you know, my parents taught me to obey authority, and that's what I did for most of my life. But that was the first time in my life, at the age of, I think it was 8 or 9 years old, that I realized that sometimes the things we're taught by authority figures might not be right, because no matter how many times someone tried to teach me that a dog was just a thing that you're allowed to beat or abuse or mercilessly slaughter, I knew from my own personal experiences that my dog Vivian was a living creature who deserved respect.
I wanted to ask you about the technique that you employ with Direct Action Everywhere, because it seems unique to me, this idea of complete transparency. You don't cover up your faces. You act in the open. And this seems like a very explicit technique, of course. Give me a sense of what the philosophy that is behind it.
It's an invitation to have a conversation. And, you know, Mr. Daniel was saying he believes in giving citizens the right to choose for themselves, and we agree completely. And I actually respect Mr. Daniels immensely. He was extremely cordial to us. He could have held us in jail for a long period of time in Utah. He declined to do that and let us get out with no bail, and I'm really appreciative of that. And I think in many ways, if Mr. Daniels and I, or frankly even a turkey farmer and I, were willing to have a conversation and able to have a conversation, we'd find that we have a lot of common values, and one of them is transparency, that we want people to see what we've seen, to hear what we've heard, and to choose for themselves whether the food choices they're making, and more importantly, whether the food choices our government is making are in alignment with our values. Mm-hmm. And what we found is, you know, it's funny, even in San Pete County Jail, when I was released, booked and released a few days ago, I met a woman at the jail who's waiting for her friend. Her husband was a turkey farmer. And when I started describing the things that I saw and describing the prosecution that was happening, she said, "What you're doing is right. It's you're being called by God to do this." And I'm not a Christian, but I am a man of faith. And when I heard that, it almost brought me to tears, because it helped me realize that even in places like San Pete County, as different as we are from people who are turkey farmers, as alien as I might seem as a Chinese Buddhist from Berkeley coming to San Pete County, there's still these important common values that people across the world believe in. And whether you're Buddhist or Mormon, compassion and respect for family, respect for life is one of them. And I'm really, in many ways, excited to start that conversation. And this court case, while it's scary and it could tear me from my family for a long period of time, it's still an opportunity for us to have a conversation that I think is long overdue.
I want to ask you about the footage itself, or the techniques for getting the footage, this virtual reality. That's also part, it seems, an important part of the message you're trying to convey, is to give people a sense, like a 360-degree sense of what, in fact, it is like in a place like that. Would you talk about that?
Virtual reality cameras are a game changer for not just activism, but frankly, the media. And the thing that every storyteller is trying to do is place you in the shoes of one of the characters in the story. And the same is true of journalists. Good journalists like yourself, I mean, you try to tell stories. You try to help people understand what someone you're talking to experienced. And there are limitations to the way we can do that through the written word or through radio. But when you have a virtual reality camera that is seeing exactly what we're seeing, when you can put on this headset and be in such an immersive environment that you feel like you're there. And one of the most astonishing things is when we put these headsets on people and ask them to walk with us into a factory farm and they see these animals, many times you'll watch people in the VR headset, they'll reach out and try and pet one of the animals. Or they'll try and open up one of the cage doors, and they have to catch themselves for a moment and realize, oh, I'm not actually there. But the other thing it does, in addition to creating just such an immersive experience, such a real and authentic experience, is it defeats one of the industry's most prominent allegations against us, and that is that our footage is not representative, that we're doctoring things, we're editing things. And I'm actually really grateful to the CEO of Norbest, Matt Cook, for acknowledging that our footage was true and accurate. But Smithfield has been investigated multiple times by us, and every single time they make the same allegation, which is that we're doctoring things, that we're editing things, that, you know, our footage is not representative. And the virtual reality camera really defeats that, because it shows you exactly what we're saying. We're not showing you one animal on a farm of 1.2 million animals. We're showing you the entire farm. You're seeing exactly what we're seeing. And as Glenn himself said, you know, we don't have the budget or technological capability to edit or doctor something like that. It would take, you know, James Cameron and CGI to create 1,000 pigs in gestation crates. And, in many ways, I wish we had that capability, but we don't have that capability. And so it makes our case more credible when we can shoot with these virtual reality 360-degree cameras.
What do you make of the question of how much coordination is going on between, you know, feds who might be influenced by industry and prosecutors like Mr. Daniels, who says he's made these decisions independently? I mean, how do you react to that question that Glenn Greenwald raises, which is there is coordination going on and it's politically based?
Yeah, as much as I wish this were not the case, there's extensive evidence that there's coordination, not just between multiple government entities, but also between corporations and these government entities. And, you know, Glenn has done a lot of great reporting on this. I take Mr. Daniels at his word, and I actually think that he probably is behaving independently. But even if you look at the pleadings by the Utah Attorney General, it's clear they've talked to prosecutors in multiple states. They've looked at investigations across the nation. It's pretty clear that they've talked to Smithfield as well. The pleadings show that there's a gentleman, who I don't know who this gentleman is, named P. Goff, who's been talking to the Utah authorities to try and get them to prosecute our case. And the, you know, it's interesting. I in many ways, I agree with Mr. Daniels. I've worked in government. I've been a lawyer. I've been a securities litigator. I've been a law professor. I've talked to friends who work at the FBI and the U.S. attorney's offices across the nation. And I agree with him that it's not some vast conspiracy. It's not, in many ways, it's not as insidious as the ordinary citizen would think, and that it's not an outright bribe where Smithfield is, you know, donating millions of dollars to politicians, which it does, and they get something in return. It's about access and influence. And no matter how many ordinary Americans call up a prosecutor in San Pete or Beaver or the Utah Attorney General, the likelihood that we're going to get a hearing is very, very low. And we know this because we've tried. Mm-hmm. When we do these investigations, we send letters, we send footage, we send CDs, DVDs to prosecutors, to Department of Agriculture officials, and try to get them to do something about this cruelty, because we think this is criminal animal cruelty. And in many ways, Matt Cook, the CEO of Norbest, acknowledges that it was criminal animal cruelty. But nothing ever happens, because we don't have a multi-billion dollar budget. We're not donating millions of dollars to politicians. So we don't even get an answer to our phone calls. So the problem here is not so much outright corruption in the classic sense. It's about access and influence shaping government policy in ways that ordinary citizens of Utah and America would not agree with.
Wayne, quick final question. We're essentially out of time, but I did want to get you to respond to Kevin Daniels saying it doesn't sound like he wants you to go to prison. And I'm wondering if you think he's an outlier in the scheme of things and what you make of that.
I think he probably is. And again, I really appreciate his compassion and kindness for us. And he was very cordial to us when we met him in court. But I think the Utah Attorney General is a very different case. And the RICO case in particular is very scary. And you only bring those sorts of cases when you're trying to send people to prison for a long time. But sometimes that's a cost of creating awareness and change. And all the defendants, we showed our faces because we knew this was possible. So
it's Wayne Chung, co-founder of the animal rights group Direct Action Everywhere, joined us from a studio in San Francisco. Wayne Chung, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Annie Lane Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.